This is Jerry Bain, podcasting for the Coalition for Networked Information, and I'm joined in conversation today with Melissa Levine, Lead Copyright Officer for the UM Copyright Office at the University of Michigan Library. Melissa, I'd like to start by asking you about the HathiTrust. Most of our listeners will have heard about the HathiTrust, but for those who haven't, can you give us a brief description of the project and tell us about the goals and what institutions are involved?
Sure. HathiTrust is actually a partnership of academic and research institutions, and we are working together to offer a collection of, it's now upwards of 10 million titles that are digitized from libraries around the world. I want to emphasize that it's a cooperative, shared digital effort, and the mission is to contribute to the common good by collecting, organizing, preserving, communicating and sharing the record of human knowledge. It's sort of very simple and very ambitious all at the same time. We currently have, I believe, over 80 institutional partners, plus the consortial partners of the CIC and the University of California. So we are actively working towards building a reliable and comprehensive, increasingly comprehensive digital archive of library materials. These are, at this point, converted from print. The partnership oversees and manages the HathiTrust collectively. We are looking for ways to improve access significantly to these materials, first and foremost for the co-owning institutions, but more broadly wherever possible. Preservation is a key part of this effort. We're trying to create reliable and accessible electronic representations of works in our collections. And a really key piece is facilitating access for people with print disabilities to these materials. You may be aware that just about a week, 2 weeks ago, the World Intellectual Property Organization finally passed a treaty dealing with access to published works for people who are blind, or visually impaired, or otherwise print disabled. And so that actually coincides nicely with the work that we've been doing for some time.
Right. I understand you work on some of the intellectual property issues related to content in the HathiTrust. What are orphan works, and why is this category of materials so important in the HathiTrust?
Orphan works are a significant issue in general for museums, libraries, archives, all kinds of educational institutions, as well as the private sector in its own way. They're broadly defined as works that are believed to be subject to copyright, but for which a copyright owner cannot be identified, located, or is unresponsive. And this is made more complex by the fact that many works indeed they have multiple copyright interests associated with them. So it's not simply a book with one author where you can make a decision based on one set of facts. So we believe that there are a considerable number of works in library collections that are not being used as productively as possible because of the difficulties of identifying rights holders. There's a renewed interest in the idea of returning to some kind of copyright formalities because of this difficulty. U.S. law used to require that a copyright, someone wanting to assert copyright, include a notice, the word copyright or a C in a circle, and register and renew with the U.S. Copyright Office. In a nutshell, when the United States joined the Berne Convention, we did away with formalities, and this came just at the time when the internet was becoming a more relevant venue for content. And it became even more important than ever to be able to associate one's copyrights with one's works. And we just have the sort of disintegration of that relationship. In any case, we are looking for efficient ways to address this. The numbers are really hard to pin down. There was a study called In From the Cold, an Assessment of the Scope of Orphan Works and Its Impact on the Delivery of Services to the Public. This was a JISC publication. And it estimated that of 503 UK institutions, that there could be in excess of 50 million orphan works. So that's one UK study. We know this is a significant issue for us. It's a significant issue nationally and internationally. The United States Copyright Office just this year offered a comment process where they sought comments from the public about the question of orphan works in the context of mass digitization. And what's interesting is there were 91 filings, and then there were an additional 89, I think, reply comments, which is a tremendous scale of response. And the kinds of comments that were filed were everything from, publishers, authors organizations, library organizations, institutional kinds of comments. But there are also a number of just one paragraph statements from individuals saying, I like this or I don't like that. You know, it's interesting to start to see members of the general public participate in these more formal processes at some level. The other interesting thing is the European Union just recently passed a directive addressing orphan works, and the individual EU countries are implementing it now. Germany just instituted a law to implement the EU directive in the last few weeks. So, frankly, because of the challenges of orphan works, we've, for several years here at the University of Michigan and for HathiTrust, focused more on working on identifying works in the public domain and the broad question of copyright determinacy, knowing as much as we can about the copyright status of works in our collections. Now, identifying works in the public domain has its own complexities, and we've been tackling them for the last several years through what's called the Copyright Review Management System. So CRMS is the nutshell phrase, or Copyright Review Management System. It is a project that started actually in 2008, maybe even earlier, you could say, in terms of planning. But the Institute for Museum and Library Services provided a grant to Michigan to work on books published in the United States between 1923 and 63. And in that time frame, you still had to have those formalities that I was mentioning. So if a work was published without those formalities, then it entered the public domain. So it's a very process-driven kind of review. And we have expanded that work to include in a second grant that began in 2011, continuing the U.S. reviews, and we've started to do what we're calling CRMS World. We are focusing there on books from the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia. Now, these are countries that were subject to the Berne Convention. And one of the features of the Berne Convention is that works enter the public domain very generally based on a life plus a number of years, minimum 50 years under the Berne Convention. So in theory, it should be somewhat easier to identify when a work enters the public domain if you're measuring it from the death date of an author, you know, an event specific. So we've had two IMLS grants, two grants from support from the Institute for Museum and Library Services. The first one set up a framework for reviewing books that were published in the United States between 1923 and 1963. And in that time frame, formalities were required. So we look at whether a book was registered, whether it was renewed, and have a process for that. That work continues, and we've started a second grant in 2011 that continues the U.S. work, but it also adds books from the U.K., Canada, and Australia. So the legal assumptions are different in those countries than they were in the U.S. at the time. The infrastructure, the interface that we use for what we call CRMS World is based on the work we did in the U.S. project, but the legal assumptions and the kinds of things we consult are different. And basically for World, the UK, Canada, and Australia have been Berne Convention countries for years and have a public domain determination based very generally on a life plus a number of years formula. So for the time frame that we're looking at, we're focusing on books, you know, before the 1940s with the theory that there are likely to be more works in the public domain in that period as we go back in time. For Canada, Australia, in that time frame, the formula was life plus 50. In the U.S., we use life plus 70, but we have, in the U.K. And then there are, we do account for the real copyright geeks out there, we do account for gap restoration. As part of joining the Berne Convention, the United States agreed to permit works, foreign works, that had entered the public domain under that 23 to 63 formalities, you know, they failed formalities. Many of those works, if they met certain criteria, were resuscitated. You know, they came back from the public domain and are actually subject to copyright in the U.S. So we do have situations where works are in the public domain outside of the U.S., but not in the U.S., and our system considers that factor. In the new grant, we are really fortunate to have a top-notch advisory board. So we have a number of copyright experts who I am able to consult with informally and formally to raise the kinds of questions that come up very routinely. I would have thought that we'd see different allocations of numbers, but what's interesting is that from 2008 to date, For the U.S. determinations, we see roughly 29% are undetermined, about 17% are in copyright, and 54%, have been in the public domain. In CRMS world, which we've only been doing reviews for about a year, the proportions play out about the same. And I can't explain it, but we're finding about 33% undetermined, 13% in copyright, which lines up with the 17% in the U.S., and about 54% in the public domain, which is exactly the same percentage as in the U.S. At some point, we'll look at this, but I don't know if that has something to do with publication patterns or is a coincidence, but it's really quite interesting. Basically, when in both of these processes, I'm going to explain what undetermined means. We look at the criteria to determine whether something is in or not in the public domain. And we have a generous swath of where we don't know. So that might mean that a work has multiple authors, so might have multiple copyright holders, and we're electing not to spend the time right now. We're sort of earmarking a book that might have many individual authors to look at that later. You might have credited images inside. You might have a forward that is tagged as having sufficient independent copyrightability that we feel that even if the work as a whole might be in the public domain, we're not sure about any particular component. So there's things like that that end up in the undetermined bucket. And at some point, we'll evaluate what those look like more carefully. One of the things that's really compelling to me also about this project is how many different institutions have rolled up their sleeves and have really dedicated real resources. We have, for the U.S. partners, the reviews are done heavily by people in Michigan's technical services catalogers, and they are working with the Indiana University, University of Minnesota, and the University of Wisconsin. And then And that work, as I mentioned, continues. Interestingly, we have about 30,000 books left in the U.S. candidate queue. They've made determinations on over 260,000 items so far, and we will probably finish the body of U.S. materials that we have available in HathiTrust at this time, hopefully by the end of this calendar year, which is really quite an accomplishment. For the World Project, which, again, we've only been doing reviews for about 12 months, we have, I think, over 15 different partners. And we have all of these materials on our website, but all of them have committed formal cost share this time. And this is a significant, I think it's a very significant indicator of the commitment to try and tackle this, because all of these libraries, you know, resources are tight, and to commit staff time to doing these reviews is a real commitment. And we are finding that the sweet spot for reviewers in terms of their learning curve and having consistency in number and quality of review is about 25%. So our current partners have a variety of percentages. If people are interested in becoming reviewers, we're asking for a minimum of 25% commitment of time by someone. What we're seeing in CRMS world is we have about 135 volumes and candidates. We started with about 175. So we're moving at a pretty good clip. In 1 year, we've had about 56,000 determinations. There's one 12-month period. And the lessons learned in the U.S. project, technically, in terms of the interface, in terms of how the back end of the system works, really helped us, I think, move things at a faster pace with World. So I've talked about U.S., I've talked about Canada, I've talked about U.S., I've talked about World. We've talked about formalities. Let's see. We are looking at things like author death dates for World, and it's not as easy to gather all that information as one might expect, so we're looking at different ways of improving efficiencies around that question. We are really leveraging established resources wherever we can. So we're using VIAF, the Virtual Internet Authority File. for both author death dates as well as information about nationality. We're using Library of Congress resources. Again, all these kinds of information are on our website. But in both U.S. and world, each work is subject to two independent reviews. So that means that two different reviewers have an interface, they have a queue that gets populated, and they do not know who else has received a work for review. They don't know what the other person has done. So this double process is part of our, you know, as they used to say, belt and suspenders around making sure that we're getting this right. We also have expert reviewers, and it doesn't mean that they're necessarily copyright experts, although that expertise develops. It's really where we have two independent reviews and they don't match. The expert will look at that to see what the issue is. And we tend to see in the world, the conflicts tend to be like a factual interpretation. Like someone will see an insert where someone else won't. But you know, some of these can be kind of subjective questions. We have a similar process in world where we have expert reviewers. They are making similar kinds of decisions where the two independent reviews do not match. And again, anything that's really complex or unresolvable, we put aside as undetermined.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about that we haven't covered?
I think it's a fundamental piece of this. And, you know, one of the things that we're really thinking about, we're about a year and a half into the current IMLS grant. We've been diligent about making our materials available on our website. And we really want to think about ways to expand the locus of the activity. We still need to ensure the quality of the reviews. I'm trying to think through, you know, a lot of people talk about crowdsourcing. I think that it's going to be challenging to do some kind of true crowdsourcing around this, but we're thinking about those kinds of ideas and whether you could break down the questions sufficiently to do that kind of thing. So we have our flow charts and our decision trees online. We have a couple little videos that show what the interface looks like. And I'm starting to get calls from other institutions, other libraries, about whether they could tackle works from a particular country, which, you know, to basically build analogous kinds of systems from this. Some of them are interested in doing something with us through CRMS. Others are wondering whether they can take our assumptions and use them for their own digital projects. So it may be that we're starting to create a framework that can be replicated in other ways. We are learning a lot about quality control, about the training, about the investments. In the first grant, we had, as I mentioned, just three partners, and we had one person who was working in a very sort of handcrafted way to do the training. And we basically took the lessons from that and have been working towards a more distributed approach. Now, it's still, you know, under 20 institutions, but it's probably close to 40 different individuals making reviews outside the University of Michigan. So we have our training materials online. We have a sandbox environment for training. It's not completely independent learning, but we're moving towards making it easier for people to participate.
Well, thanks a lot for your time, Melissa. I appreciate it. For the Coalition for Networked Information, this is Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.